From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Halloween night. Halloween morning, I should say. Halloween night, it seems like out there because it's so dark and cloudy, it's almost feels like spooky or something out there. But it's Halloween morning, October 31st, Thursday morning, actually, 2019. And we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking first off with John Klar. He is a Republican challenging Governor Phil Scott for the Republican nomination to run for governor under the Republican banner in 2020. Phil Scott, of course, is closing in on the halfway point of his second two-year term. And John Klar is running, being described in a lot of media reports this week since his announcement a couple days ago, as challenging Scott from the right. And it does seem that way. He is pro-life. He is somebody who is very much pro-business and worried about the Vermont's business climate and government getting too large. And maybe we'll let John Klar tell you a little bit more about himself. Is John on the line with us?
I am, yes. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. And you announced, was it Tuesday?
Monday,
I'm sorry. I can't even keep track of what time of day it is, whether it's Halloween morning or night or what day of the week. Or I'm a little bit in need of more coffee, I think, this morning or something. But hey, I did want to check in with you and find out a little bit about your platform as you challenge Governor Phil Scott for the Republican nomination in 2020. And I think I have it right from reading a couple of your recent commentaries that you are a staunch opponent of abortion. You thought H 57, the bill that passed this past year codifying abortion rights in Vermont law, was a really bad idea. So why don't we start with that, just because it's sort of at the top of the alphabet, maybe. How am I doing so far? Are you somebody who feels like Vermont really needs to put the brakes on here and reverse itself, what it did earlier this year?
Well, I think I'm one of many, and particularly on that issue. And I am pro-life from conception, but I am not seeking to make that law in Vermont and Alabama sort of law, nor do I think that's even wise politically. But to propose a third trimester abortion ban in Vermont is about as radical as you could get, and that's what we are doing. I am certainly not alone. And in response to your question, yes, I will thank the Democrats and progressives this year in Vermont for showing all of us through H57 both that these procedures are performed here, that they would not like us to know that, but they have advertised it for us very loudly. So now they have been the catalyst for us now having this conversation. These abortion laws are perhaps exceeded in the world only by China, where they have been alleged to have forced abortions upon women. My wife is an RN. I've written articles about this. People in the healthcare community suffer horribly when they are compelled to perform these procedures, even if they are pro-choice. And I, in my youth, was pro-life, pro-choice, I mean, but I came to understand and grow and smarten up. And so I've been called already an extremist for proposing this, and I would like to suggest that those who call this a medical procedure are the extremists. And when our attorney general files a lawsuit alleging that healthcare workers who are not willing to perform these procedures are not ethically competent to care for their own patients, I think we need to have a conversation about that patient who is in the late stages of pregnancy and about to be born.
So just to be clear, your proposal is to ban third trimester abortions in Vermont, is that right?
Yes, sir, and also to acknowledge fetal personhood in criminal cases, which this legislature has spent more than 10 years resisting. I am a former criminal attorney. I have been involved in cases where women have been murdered who were pregnant, and there were no charges against them, and there are cases, obviously, where the women survive, and there is no way for prosecutors to charge people. It is not extremist to ask for women to be protected when their babies are murdered by criminals or drunk drivers or assailants or domestic partners.
Okay, and would that protection that you describe extend beyond the third trimester into the earlier stages of pregnancy?
Well, that's to be debated by the legislature. As a gubernatorial candidate, I am standing for a policy list that many people support, but it would be up to individual legislators, if we are successful, to retake our houses to draft those details, and that's the democratic process. But certainly, I'm open to anybody telling me why it shouldn't be from conception. And Patricia Blair would be a woman who lost two babies and has been ignored by the legislature for years, whose opinion we would like to hear as well.
And so you're saying you're willing to hear proposals of a range of proposals, but the idea being to criminalize these instances where a fetus is killed in a criminal act. Is that the idea?
Yes, and I personally don't see how you could draw that line anywhere other than conception. And if people want on the left want to explain to mothers that, oh well, your baby wasn't old enough yet to qualify for criminal law protection, those of us who have been involved with miscarriages understand that it's very painful. And for those who are victims of a crime, I don't think such niceties should be drawn in the criminal sphere. I think that it's not unreasonable at all to suggest that someone who criminally causes the death of another person's child, we shouldn't be drawing lines at all, and that it should be from conception. But I'm happy to have that conversation if people want to differ, because we're going to have that conversation.
Let me ask you about what has always seemed to me to be a little bit of a contradiction, because I hear, on the one hand, a lot of Republicans talk about the desire to make government smaller and less intrusive in people's lives. You know, Grover Norquist famously has talked about making it small enough to drown it in the bathtub. I gather he was mainly referring to the federal government here, but I think the principle applies. And you used this metaphor of killing a tick. An overly bloated, bloody bloated tick that needs to be popped, and so obviously a certain skepticism about government reaching into people's lives that I hear in those cases. Wouldn't this be? I mean, if we had sort of the extreme pro-life government in action, where we were essentially policing women's reproductive lives throughout, from their teen years into menopause, wouldn't that be a huge growth in government action in individuals' lives?
No, sir, not at all. 43 states currently ban third trimester abortions. Roe versus Wade acknowledged fetal personhood and that the state had a compelling state interest to protect those children, and we are only using government within the context we've always used it, to protect human life. State versus Oliver, our Supreme Court observed that it could not legislate to protect the unborn. That was 30 years ago, and that is the Supreme Court speaking. And if you read the decision, clearly they were indicating that it would be appropriate, and they felt remorse that they could not give relief to the plaintiff in that case. And meanwhile, we have an existing case, Valencourt is the case in Vermont. I have an article about this on the Federalist, in which physicians can be sued for medical malpractice when they cause the death of a fetus. So we're just trying to clarify and straighten out some existing very incongruous law. But as far as government intrusion, when I talk about the bloated dome and that swollen tick that is sucking the blood out of Vermonters, I'm speaking particularly to the extraordinary disconnect of their policies and the economic consequences for the rest of us. There is a reason why people are leaving, and it is not sustainable to keep paying all this money. But as to government intrusion into life, a third trimester child is a human being deserving of support. We are intervening to stop murder. We certainly do it in the case of people shooting one another with a gun, and this is no different.
Okay, one last question on this broad topic of reproductive rights, abortion, et cetera, and that is... you made reference to the role of healthcare professionals here. Obviously, there was a big controversy recently at the University of Vermont Medical Center, where they were called up short by a federal agency on this topic. Would it make sense for the hospital to tell personnel, maybe issue somebody a letter on hiring, saying, we don't inquire about your religious beliefs or anything, but if you have a problem performing abortions, let's say, we'll be sure that as we hire you, we assign you to a part of the hospital, orthopedics or, oncology or some part of the hospital that doesn't have to face this. You probably wouldn't work in OB and you probably wouldn't work in the ER.
Well, that's what was already in effect, and that's what T.J. Donovan is saying is unacceptable, because the rule change would have allowed nurses and doctors that exact conscientious objection. And in a case that's alleged in Burlington at UVM by more than one nurse, which created headlines, they're told that that was specifically refused to them, and they were then knowingly put in harm's way as far as for their conscience. And my wife has been involved in these procedures. I have been involved in these procedures. They are human beings, and that's why they haunt people. So absolutely, what you've just proposed is a middle road, and that's exactly what the extremists, including our attorney general, who walks around arm in arm with Planned Parenthood, is using our tax dollars to file a national lawsuit to insultingly tell nurses they cannot and must not have that conscientious objection. And so that also is a conversation that I'm glad we're now having, and thank you.
Okay, let's shift gears here and talk about some of the other issues that are in play. I gather that you are a skeptic about marijuana, legalization, decriminalization, and certainly a retail industry in Vermont. Is that true?
Yes, sir. Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead and tell us about your position on all of that.
Well, obviously, it's a highly controversial position, and starting where you started, to increase government to intrude into people's lives more in drug enforcement is a growth of government power, and it has not worked. It did not work with alcohol prohibition. What did happen in alcohol prohibition is that the government grew huge, the whole Elliott Ness thing. The U.S. Marshal Service was expanded, government power, huge amounts of money were spent to no avail, and it created a huge black market, which we know through Capone and others. And we were willing to acknowledge it failed. We now have heroin flooding our streets with fentanyl, killing people everywhere. You cannot keep heroin, which is from a foreign nation and manufactured, out of a maximum security facility. How are you going to keep marijuana out of people's backyards? But what I hope to highlight is that I'm also a political pragmatist. Even if I wanted to ban marijuana, which is very bad, particularly for young people, the best way to keep it out of young people's hands is not to have a black market, but to have a controlled market with severe penalties for supplying to minors. And what the Democrats are doing right now is proposing a 29% tax after hosting a poll which said Vermonters favored legalization at a low tax. So what they are doing is showing their tick hand in our pockets again. And that is a civil prohibition. So they pretend to legalize it. They tax it at such exorbitant rates that it will push it underground. And as we see with the hemp market, this stuff is so prolific and grown in such huge amounts, there will be no tax revenue, there will be no regulation, and there will be an ongoing black market where our children can get this stuff. So we need to just get in down there with reality. And that's what we are trying to do right now on that issue. And also, as far as bringing back prohibition in full in Vermont, that resonates with about 7% of voters. So if we're listening to people, we have to bring forward policies that will work and that will actually pass and will actually be enacted and will actually do something. And we have a tremendous problem with opioids, and that's where our police resources need to be. Many police officers tell me they spend a lot of time looking for roaches and ashtrays when they got people that they're Narcanning. And I'm a recovery coach here in Vermont, and I deal on the front lines with the opioid crisis and with people, and I watch the people dying, and I watch their parents, and I thought that we could do more. And that's why I've stepped forward to do this. It's part of one of the reasons. So
let me just make sure I understand then. You actually would favor a retail, tightly regulated market, but low-taxed market in marijuana.
Well, it's already legal for possession, and it's illegal to sell it, which is insane. So, yes, it is already in the legislature and going through. We can't stop that train anyway.
Okay,
I imagine that. Yes, sir.
I'm just going to, pardon my interruption, I'm just trying to move the stuff along here. Do you envision going to, say, a state liquor store and they have a special section there for the marijuana products, or how would that actually be carried out?
Well, again, the legislature would have to work out the details, and I'm certainly willing to listen to people, but I don't see why not, and I have written articles about that. I think I wrote an article about that exact subject called Cannabis Brandy or something like that, and I put it up on Vermont Digger. And my point there is that I worked as a criminal defense attorney for years, and I saw alcohol destroying lives everywhere, the full docket. I never had a marijuana possession or marijuana case involving violence. So it's ironic to me that we have alcohol on our shelves and people are panicking over where the marijuana would be.
Yeah.
Alcohol kills lives, kills people, and that's also something we need to do more to stop. And we could have stronger drunk driving laws in Vermont for sure.
What about
That's just our platform?
And what about alcohol consumption? Sorry. I mean, a lot of folks out there are figuring out ways to drink heavily without maybe driving, and so they wouldn't be caught by an increased drunk driving penalty.
Well, and that's something we do through social programs, but if people want to kill themselves slowly in their homes, they do have that right. It's called free will. We cannot stop people from killing themselves or hurting themselves. We can try to help them, just like with opioids. But when I reference alcohol, what I'm suggesting is we already have a very powerful and dangerous drug that is killing people, wrecking families, and destroying children's lives that's on our shelves. So in comparison, marijuana, the statistics are all there. I don't know how else you would do it other than have it available in stores. And some localities may not want that, and people will go elsewhere. But as I say, this is already happening, and it's going to happen. And at 29%, it's just a farce, and we're exposing that farce. It shows how greedy they are. They don't even care about Vermonters having liberties. They care about getting more money. And they can take away more liberties.
We just have our time's running short, so I want to jump around a little bit and cover a couple of other issues with you. Your preferred firearms policy would be what?
My preferred firearms policy would be that offensive bill signed by Phil Scott would be repealed in fall. I have a very strong Second Amendment stance, and I stand by it 110%. But what I propose on Monday and do now is, even though I feel that way, in seeking compromise, once again, we must recognize that that's in the courts right now. And to make that my policy issue or our policy list top priority would be similar to trying to bring back cannabis prohibition, and we would not have a voice with the voters. What I am proposing is that the idea to impose a waiting period, which will destroy our gun shows and hurt our economy more, which has not been demonstrated to actually be effective, is not only silly, it's unconstitutional. The government has to demonstrate that the laws they pass are going to affect the things that they are passing them for, and they have admitted that they don't really know if it'll stop suicides. And their answer is, well, if it stops just one suicide, that's okay. Well, that's fine in their minds, but not under the U.S. Constitution. Because on that basis, the government could do anything. And second of all, there's talk about attacking our manufacturers in Vermont who provide jobs for many, many people because one weapon was used in California. They want to destroy our economy more for their ideological agenda. And going after guns the way they are is just rearranging the decks on the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, as they say. It's
yep.
not doing anything to get at why people are doing these things.
And I'm also curious to know your idea for economic development in Vermont. I mean, how would you try to encourage, business growth and encourage people to be working here and making a contribution? Your overall picture of how Vermont's economy ought to work and where it's gone wrong in recent years.
The number one thing that could be done in Vermont's economy would be to stab that tick in the belly and get the blood out. This government has onerous taxes. It has so many regulations. It has taken a well-intentioned program like Act 250 and turned it into another sword to stab businesses with. We particularly discuss farms where they continue to expand it, but the way that farms are hurts all businesses. Farms are particularly under particularly onerous regs. So if the government got out of the way and we would repeal some regulations and laws so that it was more business-friendly. If the government were able to, if we were able to bring some taxes down, then it would be more attractive, not just to bring businesses in, but for existing Vermont businesses. They're being choked. This government imposes all sorts of regs. Right now, I'm trying to get oil delivered, and it's taken me weeks because the oil delivery company has been put in the position of enforcing the government's regulation on tanks and things, which, once again, are silly because this tank, for instance, has been there for 50 years. But if the vent pipe isn't 1 1/4 inches, they put a tape on my tank and they send it to the government, and I can't get oil delivered. There are people delivering oil with 5-gallon cans because of regulations that have been put in over one or two spills. Once again, very broad sweeping regulations. So I use that as an example. There are many. And so we just need to pare back government, and then people can do what they already do. Vermont has a difficult enough time with its geography and its location to grow businesses without government making it impossible.
Let me zero in on one aspect of government regulation that may be seeing some growth recently, and that is the best management practices on farms that are designed to reduce phosphorus runoff into streams and eventually lakes, including Lake Champlain. Has the state been on the wrong path as it has developed these new regs, and would you scrap all that?
Well, yes and no. I think, again, it's about degree and balance, and I think the state is very much out of balance, however well-intentioned it might be. For decades, we hear how wonderful farming is, how much we like farming, and then they keep closing. Why is that? It happened with my grandfather with bulk tanks and other things. Many people couldn't afford it. Now, bulk tanks were a good idea. But we're at a point now where we're taking huge onerous regulations under the required agricultural practices, and we're imposing those on the very smallest of farms. It's just you have two cows, and you're treated as if you have 2,000. In fact, the majority of the agricultural pollution, which is about 40% of our total pollution, is coming from large farms, and a lot of it is already in the soil from decades of applications. And much of that was under government programs and federal programs where subsidized phosphorus was pretty much shoved down the farmers' throats. So now they're being asked to bear all of those costs. If Vermont likes farmers and farming and a farming culture and a farming landscape, then they'd better think about how onerous some of those regulations are. So as far as the smallest of farms, I think they can be left alone unless they are committing some offenses, and then we could have a reactive power rather than these broad-sweeping laws. And some of them, frankly, are silly. I mean, but it's a very complex area. We have some people that are very specialized in it, but I would also say that 60% of our pollution is coming from urban and suburban sources, and we are doing some things on that, but boy, we should turn the focus on that a little bit, because every time we pave more things and build more things, there's drain, there's runoff, there's a lot of pollution coming there too, and maybe that segment of Vermont could get the log out of their own eye a little bit rather than crushing all the farms. So we're getting all of our food from California, and it's being trucked here, which is just a nightmare environmentally. We need to encourage our local small farms. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't regulate them at all.
The give me a little personal background here. You live in Brookfield currently?
Yes, sir.
And how old are you, John?
I'm 56, and since I was 8 years old, I said, someday I'm going to live on our land. And everybody laughed at me, and now I live on it. And it was originally purchased by my great-great-great-grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, in 1815, and I'm glad my family held on to it for me.
Wow.
I'm surrounded by many family members, so we're all still here.
Uh-huh. Now, you did live up in the Northeast Kingdom for a while. I saw it somewhere in your background you were pastor of a church up there. Is that still the case? Do you commute up there, or how's that work?
Well, we lived in Kingdom for 20 years. We bought our first farm in Barton, where we built the cheese house.
Mm-hmm.
Over a number of years, I became a Christian, and then we opened the church in Westfield, which had been empty for 11 years, and we used it to collect money for a Ugandan charity. I worked for no salary. But when we moved to Brookfield 2 years ago, the commute is over 2 hours each way.
Yeah.
And so this August, we finally stopped. The commute was just very, especially my car has about 230,000 miles on it. It was on its last leg. So it was no longer really an economically efficient thing to do.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So I'm not currently the pastor there. I'm not the pastor there or anywhere else now.
Okay. And you are a farmer and a lawyer. So you're farming your land in Brookfield right now?
Yes. My wife has just harvested a bunch of potatoes before the frost. Everybody should get busy. And we'll see if I have lambs this morning. I'm a little late out this morning because I wanted to take this call. I'm speaking to you from a generator. We're completely off-grid. I built the house myself out of timbers I cut myself. And I hope that everybody sees how dangerous I am to my thick-belly opponents at the Bloated Dome, because I am a farmer who's a lawyer. And most farmers cannot afford a lawyer, and most lawyers do not understand farming in the detail that I do and don't understand how important it is. And I am infused very much by the writings of Wendell Berry, whom I hope people will read, because he has been addressing these problems of sustainability for decades before large corporations decided to charge us money to figure it out for us. And so in answer to your question, yes, we brought sheep back to the mountain. There hadn't been sheep here since the 60s. I have Dorsets and Corriedales.
Wow, how many sheep do you have?
I have 13, plus whatever unborn babies are going to join me soon. I have some bred for the fall, which I haven't done. When we sold the farm in Barton, we had over 100 sheep. about 40 pigs, 70 goats, 20 or 30 cows, and a bunch of Percheron horses. So I've downsized, and my wife is amazed that I haven't bought more cows. I have a bit of an addiction to cows.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there are more discussions about just what livestock are going to be gracing the Clara household in the months and years to come. That'll like to be a fly on the wall when you tell your wife, I think I'll get another half dozen cows. That's for you guys to figure out.
She would welcome it. Uh-huh. She likes cows too.
Well, that's good. That's excellent. John Clark, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. This has been an interesting conversation, and I suspect we may be able to touch base again a couple times in the course of this campaign. And safe travels around the trail. You going to try to drive all over the state with your car with 300,000 miles on it?
Well, I'm trying to get a new car with 150,000 miles.
That'd be new. Yeah, that would feel new to somebody. Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take a brief break for some bottom-of-the-hour CBS news from the our good friends down there with CBS, and they're going to be following up with a one-on-one interview with one of the CBS correspondents, and then John Walters will be joining us in the second half hour of the program. Stay with us, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smart Wool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, and I think on the phone we have Bill Rakoff of CBS News, who's going to fill us in on the latest from Washington. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I wanted to check in with you to find out, I guess the House is going to be voting today on sort of the ground rules for a public impeachment process now. Do I understand that right?
Yeah, that is correct. In fact, they have just now started debate within the last 10 minutes or so on, it's officially called House Resolution 660, and it's a resolution that would sort of codify, in the words of some Democrats, what's been happening up till now and pave the way for the future of the impeachment inquiry, which is, we understand, to include public hearings sometime next month, hoping to wrap all of this up before the Christmas break. Some strong opposition from the Republicans to this. They feel that the process has been unfair. They feel that the resolution really doesn't change anything and keeps the power of the impeachment inquiry in the hands of Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. But Democrats say no. I mean, it's the way it's supposed to be. You wanted public hearings. We're going to lay the rules for public hearings. You wanted to be able to participate. You can participate. And, oh, by the way, the president and Republicans will be able to do what they want to when these things hit the actual articles of impeachment phase, if there are any to be drawn up. That's when they say that everybody gets their crack at it. But right now they're treating it as an investigation.
And the so this process is, the Democrats have essentially, it looked like they were initially conceding some stuff to the Republicans about how the process would work, more public, more transparent, more involvement by lawyers for the president, etc. But it's still not good enough.
No, not for Republicans, and essentially this, some Democrats essentially say this was calling the Republicans' bluff. They said it's not transparent, it's not fair, it's not open, nobody knows what's going on. So they say, okay, we're going to lay down the rules on this, which is something they wanted. They wanted transparency, they wanted the ability to have open hearings. Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, said yesterday, he says, we're giving you everything that you want. He says, but it doesn't seem like you guys are taking the bait. Instead, you guys are continuing to argue about the process rather than the substance of the investigation. And that's where the dividing line remains, even as we go through this vote today.
Eventually, this will make it over to the Senate. I mean, it really looks like the House has, with the Democratic majority and a lot of people really on board with this process now on the Democratic side, that you're going to end up with articles of impeachment being sent to the Senate. I saw something in the last day or two indicating that Mitch McConnell was at least considering the idea of a sort of almost an instant dismissal of some kind in the Senate. Is that still in play? Does that have any chance of happening, or what's happening on that front?
I don't think that would be politically expedient for the majority leader, although it may get rid of the initial heat. I don't see that happening. Previously, McConnell has said that he would, he's got no choice, really. If they bring the articles of impeachment, they have to have the hearing. Yes, there was some thought that Republicans might try to pull some procedural maneuvers to try to stop it in its tracks, but, most of us up here don't think that that's really going to happen. That McConnell's going to have to let this play out. And then it's largely going to be out of his hands because it'll be the Chief Justice of the United States sitting over an impeachment trial if there is one.
And an awful lot of what he's going to do, I would think, would be just determined about he's going to be very closely watching what the polls are in individual states where Republican senators are up in 2020. And his fundamental questions is, how am I doing on retaining my Republican majority?
Yeah, and, it's never easy when you're coming into an election year if you're a leader of your own party to try to figure out how to proceed legislatively because you are always taking those things into consideration. What do we move? What don't we move? Who's vulnerable if they have to vote against it? I mean, who can we let slide if they have to vote against it? Who do we have to hold their toes to the fire? Just crank the amp to 11 when you talk about impeachment and all of this because it's such a hot-button issue. So, no, don't envy Mitch McConnell's job. He certainly has the stature and the experience to get it done. But it's not a fun job when you're trying to hold all the horses in the corral.
Trying to hold all the horses in the corral. Bill Rakoff, thanks very much for joining me this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. Let's turn our attention now to our next guest. John Walters is a blogger. He has the Vermont Political Observer blog, and he's been a guest on the Dave Graham Show here probably, a dozen times now in the roughly year and a half I've been doing this, and I really appreciate John coming back in his new guise. For the first part of my career in talk radio, I was having him on as the columnist, the Fair Game columnist for 7 days, and there's been a recent change there, and actually a little bit of a twist on that change announced this week. What's going on, John?
Well, I can tell you secondhand from what I've read. At the time when I left 7 days in August, they weren't sure whether they were going to continue the Fair Game column or not, and they announced their decision yesterday. They are killing the column. They say there is some chance of bringing it back at some point in the future, but I doubt that. They have, to fill my opening, they have hired another reporter for their Statehouse Bureau, and that reporter, Colin Flanders, will be, doing straight journalism. They're going to kill the column. I appreciate the effort, and I really honor the effort of 7 days to maintain a robust news staff in these times when we have fewer and fewer reporters all the time. I do think that the Vermont, those who are interested in Vermont politics will miss Fair Game. That's a column with 25 years of history behind it. I was only there for the last couple of years, so I'm at the tail end of that train. But it was a unique place that a lot of people turned to for what's going on and sort of explaining how and why and maybe some of the background behind what's going on. It was really about the only place for regular sort of political analysis and commentary in the Vermont media. So they will have more journalism there, which will have its benefits. But sorry to see Fair Game go.
I think it is a sign of the changing media diet in Vermont. I mean, it used to be, when I was first working in Vermont as a reporter back in the 80s, working for the Associated Press, we'd get our sort of daily news coverage and what's going on at the Statehouse from a three-person. We were covering it at the AP, of course. The Times, Argus, and Rutland Herald had a three-person bureau in Montpelier covering the Statehouse and all the political goings on in Vermont. And, of course, the Burlington Free Press at the time had three reporters working under the Golden Dome in Montpelier. And the Times, Argus, and the Free Press have scaled back to, the Times, Argus has really scaled back to nothing in terms of its own Statehouse coverage. Yeah. The Free Press is pretty close to that these days. And so there's this void of sort of standard who's filing what bill and who's and what lobbyists are pushing which bill and who's making the trade-offs and all that kind of stuff. And the there is a void there that needs to be filled. And I think 7 days just is sort of seeing that. Obviously, we now have a new entry on – recent entry on the scene is VT Digger, and VPR has beefed up its staff some. So it's not a complete void, but, boy – I agree. There's just a lot less daily coverage of Vermont political and government news than there was 30 years ago, and I think 7 days is probably seeing that.
Yeah.
But back in those days, you know, we would rely on our on the AP stuff, the Free Press, the Rutland Herald, and we would be watching the news flow in those places, and then we'd pick up. What was it called back then? The Vanguard Press for a while, or Vermont? It wasn't 7 days yet, but it was sort of the precursor of 7 days. And we'd pick up that paper, and really that was the first place you'd turn in the paper was that column,
and which, by Peter Frain.
For a long time, Frain had that column, and it was funny and irreverent, and just. You know, really sort of tasted like frosting on the cake of the regular coverage in the other publications, and that was pretty. Those were pretty heady days. I don't think we appreciated them enough back then, or something. But
yeah, it's. I mean, Digger is the only outlet these days that's really sort of doing the meat and potatoes. You know, going to the press conferences and covering the big bills and the latest developments on a day to day basis.
Yep.
Which there used to be a lot of reporters covering, and. You know, what you get then is you get the Digger slice of whatever the top stories are, and then there's a lot of no coverage. Whereas in the old days, if you had a three-person bureau, you would have one reporter who would cover the top story, but you'd have a couple of other reporters who were poking around and going to other hearings and, you know, following developments that maybe weren't quite ripe yet. And so there was a lot more depth to the news coverage now. And I think as Digger takes on... tries to do the meat and potatoes and also provide some, you know, depth and context. 7 days is positioning itself, I think, as an exploratory place for in-depth coverage of specific stories and specific issues. And so they see more value for themselves and the readers in you know, adding another reporter to their reporting team than in maintaining the column.
There is another force entering the scene in Vermont journalism in recent years, which I'm not convinced is altogether healthy because it is different. It is really not journalism in the traditional sense, because journalism in the traditional sense, you know, people will dispute me on this, but they basically you show up for work at the beginning of the day, and you're not supposed to be setting out with an ideological agenda. And some of the new entrants on the scene, you know, True North Reports, you know, the publications Guy Page is doing, you know, I like Guy. He's a thoughtful fella, and he is, but he definitely has a point of view, and he shows up with a conservative agenda, and all the news that you read from him pretty much has that spin on it. And I mean, the thing even about Frain was a liberal. I mean, and you lean liberal, John, and in your 7 days column and in your blog. But the thing is that you allow yourself occasionally to write a column saying that the Democrats are behaving like idiots. You know,
I have always been more than happy to call the Democrats out on their stuff.
Yeah,
as anyone else, and in fact, perhaps more so because the Democrats have so much power that they are more likely to screw up in significant ways.
You like to beat up the overdog. I mean, that's sort of, you know, afflict the comfortable is an old principle in journalism.
Yeah.
I actually think that that these new outlets is on the right, you know, what is it? It's True North. It's I'm missing one. There's a this thing Bob Prenier is doing now. It's a online Vermont news presentation that he's doing, and you know they start out from this idea that we're gonna use a sort of news-like vehicle to push a conservative agenda.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I hear from our callers sometimes on the media are biased liberal. And I say to them, I've never gone into a newsroom in the morning and been told, you got to put a liberal spin on your story. You know, it's not the case. You're told go out and get the story,
yeah.
And it's a different, it's a whole different structure of the way to think about it.
Yeah, and you know, there's a place, if you go back far enough in the history of American journalism, you know, newspapers used to have points of view. You would sometimes go into a town and there would be one paper called the Republican and one paper called the Democrat.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you read both of them and sort of like tried to average them out, maybe you'd arrive at some semblance of the truth. But, you know, journalism has evolved since then, and it does have principles and it does have guidelines, and you are expected to present all points of view and talk to people on all sides and try to balance out your coverage. And so, you know, if you're doing a good job as a journalist, you come to conclusions. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's actual news to report and it happens to hurt one side or the other, then that's what you do. If all that kind of journalism was heavily supported by advertising revenue, and yep. That advertising revenue is largely gone to the internet, to, you know, Craigslist, to, you know, mm-hmm. Amazon, to you know, away from
Facebook,
newspapers.
Google, yeah.
And the result is that there isn't enough money to maintain that journalistic space, and now if it is being supplanted by organizations that are funded by interests with a particular interest in mind, whether that is left or right, then those outlets really can't be trusted. And if you only read that content, then you're not getting the full picture, again, whether it's right or left.
We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Jeff in Braintree. Good morning, Jeff.
I wonder if I could go back to the conversation you just had about impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
What the Republicans are complaining about, I just heard a little bit of it, and what the Republicans are complaining about is that from Steve Scalise, who is very reputable, Lee Zeldin, those guys, when they get a chance to ask questions, they're not allowed to, and when they are allowed to ask a question, Schiff informs the witnesses not to answer. That is what the Republicans are complaining about in this procedure.
Schiff informs the witnesses not to answer?
Yes, that's Steve Scalise came right on. I've seen him say that several times, and you guys are not, you listen to this guy you talk to, he's not telling the whole truth.
Well,
that's what they're ugly about. They're not ugly because they're not there. They're ugly because they aren't allowed to participate in the questions, asking questions, and Schiff is instructing the witnesses not to answer.
Yeah, John,
I have not heard that. I've heard the opposite.
It several times. I guess you're not listening to the right news outfit, I guess.
Or as I just said about news outlets with axes to grind on both sides of the aisle, maybe you're only listening to the ones who...
I'm listening to Fox News, and I've found over the years that Fox News is the most accurate news outfit that there is. They're far more accurate than any other.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Good talking with you. I wanted to shift gears a little bit to the broader political picture here in Vermont, John. We have a new candidate on the scene this week, in fact. That would be John Klar. And what's he up to?
Your guest in the first half hour. He is presenting himself as basically a conservative alternative to Governor Phil Scott. There is a broad swath of the Republican Party in Vermont that would like a more conservative governor, and dissatisfied with Scott's centrist leanings. And so he is going to try to carry that banner. He's an interesting guy. I give a lot of respect to his life story and what he has done and what he's accomplished. This has been a hopeless task in the past, and I think it's probably going to be a hopeless task again now. Like I said, he could cause a little trouble. He'll certainly make the Republican primary more interesting, assuming the governor runs for re-election.
Yeah, this is all based on that assumption. Now, yeah. I think that there's, or you tell me. I mean, you follow politics more closely than I do. I sort of 10,000 foot view, and you're down there in the trenches with folks. What are the chances that the Republican primary could shape up to be Primaries are known for drawing out the activists, you know, the hardcore, the hardcore party people. And, you know, Phil Scott is known as someone who has some Republican support, but a lot of support from people who don't really have a political party. And his kind of voter, I would guess, would be less likely to show up for a primary.
I think that's possible. I think there is still, I mean, there's a broad acknowledgement among many Republicans that even though they are to the right of Governor Scott, that he is their best hope to keep the governorship and to provide a counterweight to the overwhelmingly Democratic legislature. And so you have, you know, I know a lot of conservative Republicans who would prefer to have a more robust policy on things like taxes and the size of government. But they understand that in the current environment that Phil Scott is at least better than Democrat X. So I think it would take a lot for someone like John Klar to mount a really serious challenge to Governor Scott. That said, he is well within his rights, and it does make for a better debate to not let the incumbent just sail right through. So I hope that he catches on, and I hope that he finds a base, and I hope he can carry his message through at least the primary season. I know, you know, you said, you know, is this something the governor should worry about? And yeah, I mean, 2 years ago with Keith Stern, who was a pro-gun conservative, who challenged Governor Scott, that the Team Scott did keep their eye on that, and they were a little worried at first that the backlash to gun legislation might lead Keith Stern to have some success. It didn't happen.
No.
We shall wait and see if it will happen this time around.
I think it takes somebody who is a good, strong candidate personally and has, you know, is well-spoken and you know, an attractive person just in general. I also think that there's maybe a coalition that could add up here of, you know, the Second Amendment advocates didn't really carry it last time. And maybe it's because there aren't as many Second Amendment advocates as they want you to believe. If you add those folks to the pro-life advocates, who are also going to be attracted to theoretically anyway, to John Klar over Phil Scott, then you might start to actually build something. That's the thing that I mean. I think the governor might worry a little more this time.
It could very well be. I'm sure that they will be paying attention if they do internal polling and they find that there is any softness in the governor's support. I think they will, you know, maybe open up the bank book a little bit. But the truth is, I mean, John Klar and people like him will have a lot of trouble raising enough money to have an organization and be statewide. And you know, it's very difficult to be an unknown and present yourself to the entire state of Vermont.
Yeah, that's
that
true.
In itself is a big, big obstacle. And if he can generate some grassroots enthusiasm, then, you know, he has a chance to make some noise.
One last thing in the last minute or so, which is the Democrats have a candidate, Rebecca Holcomb, running to be the nominee to run against Phil Scott, assuming, again, that the governor runs for re-election. The Democratic Party this week, according to V.T. Digger, is actually polling to see whether David Zuckerman, lieutenant governor, or Attorney General T.J. Donovan would be a stronger candidate.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, my interpretation, this is not based on any inside information, but I have to think that if the party is doing this polling, what they are hoping is that the results will encourage either Zuckerman or Donovan to enter the race. They would like to have a candidate with more statewide recognition than Rebecca Holcomb.
Mm-hmm.
And if these polls show any softness in the governor's standing, then that might entice either man into the race and you know, be a stronger candidate potentially against Phil Scott next year.
All right. Well, John Walters, thanks so much for coming by this morning. It's going to have to about do for this segment of the Dave Graham Show. And we will be back after some CBS News at the top of the hour, a couple words from sponsors, and looking into crop diversity with some folks from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and a farmer from down in the Connecticut River Valley. We'll be back, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our Rockin' Deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smartwool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Hi, this is Tom Mihiron.
Are we back? I think we're back.
Yeah, I thumbed it. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We'll save Tom Mihiron for another juncture here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we like Tom Mihiron a lot and the Mihiron's market down there in Waitsfield. But we'll save them up for another full presentation a little bit later. Anyway, we continue into the second hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM, and really appreciate all you listeners out there staying with us. Been lots of interesting stuff going on the show this week, and I suspect that maybe some people have been itching to get on the air here and offer up their views. I've got a little bit of open time here because we're not going to be talking to our folks, our guests from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences for another 10 or 15 minutes. So if you would like to call in and just share any thoughts that have been prompted by our discussions here on the air this week, you are more than welcome to do so. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. We had quite a discussion, a full two-hour show yesterday on the situation in the Harwood Unified Union School District and their questions about how to react to flat or declining enrollments in the schools and how to react to the state's Act 46 law that combined administrations and school boards around Vermont. And should this school district be thinking about closing one of the elementary schools? It seems as though Faiston is the one most likely that would be on the block if in fact that were the decision. The board is going to be deciding apparently on November 13th what to present to voters on town meeting day in March, and that's going to be I think it's a tough question. I mean, I was talking with a couple of board members in the last couple of weeks who all of them, even those who are saying that they may have to end up supporting the decision to close the Faiston Elementary School, are feeling like it's really painful and tough and difficult for the community, and they're very sympathetic to folks who oppose closing the school. And but on the other hand, they're trying to figure out the best way to both keep taxes within some realm of reasonableness in the school district's region, as well as provide students with the best quality education they can develop. So it's always a balancing act, and it goes on all over Vermont. It's a struggle for folks to think about their annual property tax bill and how are we going to pay for our schools and keep the schools really vibrant and moving into the future and staying up with the state of the art and all the various subjects they teach and so on and so forth, while at the same time allowing folks to continue to live in the communities where many people have lived for their entire lives. They have multi-generational family homes that are suddenly becoming unaffordable by virtue of property taxes in some cases. And so it's a tough call. And I really, as I said the other day when we had Tari Smith, one of the board members, as a guest on the show, and I said to her, you know, these people typically get paid in most Vermont communities $1,000 a year or less to serve on a school board. And it's many hours on a weekly basis, sometimes 20 hours a week. And they're doing it for the love of their communities. You know, that's what it's all about. And I just tip my hat. I mean, I think that there's real value to that kind of approach to life around here that I think goes underappreciated sometimes. You know, when these school boards are trying to make really tough decisions and they come under a lot of grief from community members and so on, you also have to stand back and just remember they're trying to make the best decisions they can given the various pressures, and they are working their tails off to get all these decisions made and to do so in the most thoughtful and well-informed manner possible. And it's not always easy, for sure. So Obviously, folks have had a number of thoughts that they wanted to share with us about goings-on in Washington. We have the U.S. House of Representatives continuing its impeachment inquiry. In fact, today there's voting going on about a plan to try to open this up a little bit and involve more participation by the president's administration. It's a really interesting thing. I think the, you know, I always read in civics class and so on that if there's going to be an impeachment, the House offers up articles of impeachment in the form of an indictment, and then the Senate actually is the body that acts as the jury. So in the court system, the outfit that offers up an indictment is often a grand jury, and the grand jury operates totally in secret, and there's no chance for defense counsel to get in front of a grand jury. That's why there's a famous line from some judge somewhere, which I think was something about how a grand jury can be convinced to indict a ham sandwich. And I think he was trying to be funny, although ham sandwiches could probably be indicted for having too high cholesterol or something. I don't know these days. You never know. The but it's not a parallel thing, apparently, in the Congress. It's not – the House isn't – doesn't operate as a grand jury. It is a – instead, it's a at least somewhat more open process, which they're going to get to apparently later this month with public hearings on the House side before the matter ever gets to the Senate. So let's hear what Bill from Middlebury has to say about all this. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. I probably missed this when you were talking yesterday. It may have been brought up, but I wasn't available to listen. Was anything said yesterday in regards to the $130,000 income limit for state payments?
I'm sorry, say again?
So the state law has income limits for income sensitivity, meaning that if you earn a certain amount of money, you're only allowed to pay a certain amount of education taxes.
Oh, I see. Okay, yep, I get you.
Yeah, I was curious about how it was brought up yesterday.
Didn't hear any discussion of that. That's an interesting question. How do you think that impacts these decisions right now?
Well, I think that what's happening in Montpelier, honestly, is that there's downward pressure on the select boards, and they, you know, they're feeling the weight of the state saying that we need to spend less at a local level per student. But on the same token, if you earn less than $130,000 a year, it doesn't really matter what tax rate is within your individual community. You're only allowed to pay a certain amount of tax, and so it kind of flies in the face a little bit for this idea of closing schools, simply because if you earn $50,000 a year, for instance, you're only allowed to pay a certain percentage of your income into taxes, and your state there's a state payment that's on your tax bill that then reflects what you're allowed to pay. And so even if FASTM was left open or FASTM was closed, you're still only allowed to pay X amount of dollars in education taxes a year.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And so what you're saying, it sounds like, is that maybe sometimes a discussion about people worrying about property taxes may be overplayed a little bit because there is this cushioning effect of that income sensitivity. Is that right?
That's correct. If you look at the there's two different tax rates mm-hmm. For education. There's the non-residential tax rate, and then there's the local homestead rate. And the homestead rate is the one that gets impacted when you vote on your different budgets, because that one that can go up or down depending on what your per pupil spending is. The non-residential rate is set by the state, and it doesn't matter what you do locally. And so as a result, if you as a voter in your town are earning, let's say, $50,000 a year, you could spend $30,000 a year per pupil, and you're still going to be paying the same amount in tax.
I get you. It's an interesting point. I mean, I guess the counter to this, though, might be to say it's all going to come out of some pocket. I mean, in other words, and if you're paying basically income taxes to support education instead of a property tax, which may be the case with lower income voters, you don't pay that much in income taxes either. But there still is a tax impact, even if it's cushioned, isn't there?
Ultimately, everybody's got to pay into the system.
Right.
And so as a result, you're absolutely right. It's got to come out of someplace. But the problem is that where it's really hurting people is those individuals that are, you know, for argument's sake, it's over $100,000, because
yeah.
Once you get to the 100 to 130, you've got to have a pretty high tax bill to get a state payment, to be honest with you. But
yeah.
Anybody that earns over $100,000, which isn't a lot of Vermonters, frankly, combined income, you know, median is like, what, $65,000 per year, something like that. And so the result is that, you know, whether they close the school or not, the tax bill is still going to be the same. And so I don't know that discussion's been had and people really understand that even if they close Facing School, their tax bill's not going to change one penny.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks for the call. I think you raised an interesting point here, and maybe the next time we have that, have those folks from Harwood on, some of them are already clamoring for another show devoted to the topic. I will bring that up because I do think it's an interesting point. So appreciate the call. Thank you so much. One of the issues that I've actually had a chance to touch on at least once before on the Dave Graham Show here that I think is really a fascinating one has to do with crop diversity. And we decided that we were going to talk a little bit about that again today as part of our weekly Seeds to Society segment. This is something that we do in the second hour of every Thursday program here with help from the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And they've been very kindly setting us up with interviews with folks to talk about a wide range of issues that do relate to agriculture, sometimes a little bit tangentially. We had a robust discussion last week about the upcoming U.S. Census of 2020, and it may not immediately make that connection, but certainly there are issues where agriculture and those kinds of pursuits and census issues overlap. So we were able to get into some of that a little bit in the case at hand, this October 31st, we are welcoming Eric Bishop von Wettberg, who is an evolutionary ecologist at the University of Vermont, and we're going to be talking a little bit about crop diversity and plant ecology, plant evolution, and I'm hoping that we will also be hearing from a couple of other guests who are on the list but haven't checked in yet. I believe we have a farmer by the name of, and Eric, maybe, first, Eric, welcome to the program this morning. I know we have you on the line, right?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you very much. Sure. And still waiting to hear from, is it Nando or Nando Jaramillo?
Yes, I hope Nando and his partner Karen will be joining us.
Okay.
They would be calling from the other side of the state. So.
Right. They are farmers down in Norwich, is it, or somewhere in the Connecticut Valley, I know?
Yes. Nando has a amazing food truck in his kitchen where he's selling Colombian arepas. They're delicious.
Colombian, what's the?
Arepa.
O-R-E-P-A, is it?
A-R-E-P-A.
A-R-E-P-A.
My Spanish is not a model that others should follow.
Okay.
But,
that's quite all right. I understand that one of the things that Nando and Karen are doing is working in trying to preserve heirloom corn varieties. Is that right?
That is correct. Colombians have grown corn, or they would often call it maize, for nearly 6,000 years, maybe longer. And the varieties that come from the highlands and the Andes, they tend to have big seeds. They tend to have a filling, crunchy texture or mouthfeel. And they grind them up, not that dissimilar to corn grits in the South. And they'll make essentially corn cakes. And that's what an arepa is, often mixed with cheese or meat, a nice sauce. When Nando was a child, he was moving between the U.S. and Colombia with his parents, and his grandmother's arepas really spoke to him. He's noted as he's gotten older that the taste is different, and that's because elite varieties of corn developed in the U.S. Simply don't have quite that same texture. They produce more, but they're not the traditional varieties.
And I would imagine that would make a huge difference in the overall texture and quality of the product being made. In this case, an arepa, and that does sound like. By the way, you're making me hungry as you describe this this food item here. I sometimes get that way anyway in the late morning, but this sounds particularly delicious. And Your role in all of this, are you with the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences? Is that where you are?
I'm an associate professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I teach courses in crop breeding, ways in which we make crops better. I also have a number of research projects with different groups in the state and more broadly to preserve crop genetic diversity. And that's the primary thing that we do. We try to take an ecological approach to preserving the diversity that's out there and is often not utilized and not being preserved.
It's a fascinating area, this issue of crop diversity, and I'm wondering if you could describe to us what are some of the forces that are working against crop diversity. Why is this a problem that I'm hearing about from a variety of quarters these days?
So, a century ago, or a century and a half ago, most farmers would have obtained the seeds that they grew from seeds they kept themselves. Whatever they had the year before, if they had a bad harvest, they might have gotten more seeds from their neighbors or even a neighboring village. But in general, people just grew what they had. One of the things that has improved our agricultural economy over the last century or more is we have introduced new crops. And as we've gotten better at caring for agricultural environments, we've increasingly fertilized them to the point where it's too much, and we've bred crops to handle that. So as agriculture's changed over the last century, farmers increasingly all over the world buy their seeds, and those have been bred to perform well in high-input agricultural environments, and that has simply eroded the amount of diversity that farmers grow and leads to the loss of unique seed varieties.
I was learning recently about rice in India. There was a speaker at Sterling College up in Craftsbury Common just a few weeks ago who came in, who is an Indian farmer and is actually has a nursery essentially in India for rice of a wide range of local varieties from various parts of that country, and same issues playing out there where he's very worried about rice varieties being narrowed in number to the degree where some of them become less adaptable depending on climate or depending on soil types, and then there's the whole culinary aspect of it. You want different kinds of rice depending on the kind of dish you're making, right?
Correct. Dibal Deb gave a fascinating talk. He gave a second one over here at UVM.
Oh, I didn't know he came to UVM. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
He when you're going to come all the way from India,
you might as well make two stops in Vermont, right?
Yes. He has done some fascinating work and been a leader in small-scale gene banking.
Mm-hmm.
For nearly a century, we've had national-level gene banks that preserve a lot of genetic diversity. Since 1898, USDA had a plant introduction service led by the great David Fairchild
mm-hmm.
that introduced new crops to the U.S. and started creating essentially a library of the seeds that they had. So the early work of David Fairchild brought citrus and soybeans and the cherry trees in Washington, D.C., and mangoes to the U.S. That has grown into a large gene bank with millions of accessions or individual seeds or cuttings of different crops.
Mm-hmm.
But that gene bank is is often invisible to farmers, and it takes that material out of the context where people know how to cook it or how to grow it. And there's a loss of ecological and social information with that.
Eric, I want to Eric Bishop von Wetberg. Am I pronouncing that right, by the way, or do you go the old country von Wetberg or something?
Great, great, great grandfather took a bullet for the Union Army.
Okay.
In the Battle of the Wilderness.
Yep.
And since 1916, it's been completely Americanized.
Okay, that's fair. I just wanted to double check. I like to pronounce things correctly on the radio if I can. So, I want to also mention that we do have now on the line. We are having a little bit of a slowdown getting hooked up, but I think right now we do have on the line. Is it Nando Jaramillo?
Yes, sir.
And thank you very much for joining us. And you are with Karen, is it Karen Ganey?
Yeah, Karen couldn't make it. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I'm sure you could tell your story because the two of you are partners and are working together. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So Nando, where are you based? You're down in the Connecticut River Valley, right?
Yeah, we're right here in Norwich.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know. I gravitated towards this area of the state because of my children's education.
Sure.
They go to school near here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, try to be closer to the school. So, I came here a couple of years ago and I fell in love with this, you know, and I think that, you guys here in Vermont are doing a great job on maintaining the whole infrastructure and the way that we, you know, should be moving towards, you know, maintaining this. And I saw how farmers were growing corn for silage, and I've always wanted to grow corn to make real arepas because I've seen the problems that all this GMOs have done in culturally, you know, Latin America with all this cultural food, you know?
Wow. Now, this is very interesting to me, and I really I'm really glad you're able to be a guest on the program this morning. And Nando Jaramillo, or is it Jaramillo? I want to pronounce Jaramillo. What's the
problem? Jaramillo.
Jaramillo, okay. I got to remember my Spanish pronunciations from I took a little bit in school, but no me acuerdo mucho. So so let's see. I was going to ask you about these arepas. Are they actually items that you have a food truck? Are they items that you are selling on your food truck?
Yeah, I have a little farm in Miami, and I had this little trailer that I used to take to farmers markets. I've always been making food.
Yep.
So I used to sell beans, this cargamento beans that we grow down there.
Nando, I got to interrupt you. I hate to do this, but let's talk after the break. We got to hear a little bit of CBS News here, a couple words from sponsors, and I do want to hear the story of the food truck when we come back. We'll get back to it. Back shortly, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smart Wool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back. My guests are Eric Bishop von Wetberg of the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. He is an evolutionary ecologist at UVM. And also on the phone with us is Nando, I hope I get this right this time, Jaramillo. Originally from Colombia, right?
Yes, sir.
And you've been in Vermont for how long now?
this is going to be my second winter here.
Okay. winters mark the thing, right? Is that how you count?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
They must be still be seem pretty remarkable to you coming from Colombia. But let me ask you, we were talking just before the break, and I'm sorry I had to interrupt to do the official business here, but we were talking about the your food truck and some of your experiences. Did you say that you had spent some time in Miami?
Yeah. So yeah, we had this project out there in Miami with the county.
Mm-hmm.
We're building a sustainability center, and you know, Miami is going through a huge gentrification problem, and the land that we were using that the county had awarded us was in the middle of all this big development that's happening down there near downtown Miami, and we got kind of like pushed out. So
yeah.
You know, I've always been involved in the nonprofit sector,
mm-hmm.
and working with the nonprofit that I work with, which is going through a whole transformation because of personal things, and the idea of growing corn started 2 years ago when I came here, and we decided to you know, relocate here and see how we can make grow corn and bring back that staple food, which is the arepa, in our region. You know, I grew up eating arepas, and I saw the transformation of the flavor and the texture, and become accustomed to something that is not even real, you know?
Yeah. So basically, you had this traditional dish that came from Colombia, or at least that part of the world, and you grew up with it, and you wanted to make it in the United States, and you come up here and you're looking around for the right ingredients in the form of, in this case, the correct corn to use. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you discover that you can't really get the correct corn in the United States to make the arepa correct from the point of view of how you remember it from Colombia.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. And that gets us back to this issue of crop diversity. And I want to bring Erica Bishop von Wetberg back into the conversation here. Is the reason for that this overall, is this sort of part and parcel, Eric, of the overall issue of crop diversity narrowing?
Yeah, it is. Crop diversity has been narrowing, particularly for corn, since the 1920s and 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
We do feed almost all of the corn that we grow, and we're very good at growing corn in the U.S. We feed almost all of it to cows or other livestock.
Yep.
And certainly what a cow is looking for in corn is not as refined as what a person is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
The range that we would eat has certainly declined. The Abenaki, when people from Europe arrived in the Northeast, would have been growing varieties of corn that are actually in their texture and flavor pretty similar to the Colombian varieties that Nando grew up with.
Hmm. You know, when I think of corn, because I probably have such limited exposure to crop diversity myself in my own diet and shopping habits and so on, occasionally in the summertime we'll go to a farm stand and we'll pick up a half dozen ears of I think what's called sweet corn, or sometimes I hear it called, what is it, butter and sugar corn, I guess. Are these anything close, or are they way wrong in terms of what's needed to make an arepa?
What do you think, David? I don't.
Did I stump you?
Yeah,
not for me. No, I'll give my answer as a geneticist. So
yep.
The sweet corns have a history going back to at least the Iroquois and Haudenosaunee, who first introduced people of European descent to sweet corns. they are distinct in the accumulation of sugar from other corn varieties that are going to be starchier, a little bit more fibrous. They have changed significantly. The first commercial sweet corn was released in the early 1900s, Bantam's Golden, and it was sweeter than previous sweet corns. And the sweet corns we have now are much sweeter, to the point where the sugar content they have really won't hold up well in something like grits or polenta or cornbread or arepas or tortillas.
Yeah.
They're just too soft and sugary.
Right.
To handle that well. I grew up in upstate New York, and my father would plant a large stand of sweet corn every summer, and he'd get a special glint in his eyes as it started to mature. It can be wonderful, but it's not the same.
Now, Nando, I want to ask you, you were saying that you've had difficulty finding the right kinds of corn to mix into your arepas, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about what do you need? I mean, do you need a corn that's a little starchier and maybe not, surely not as sugary and sweet? Is there a description that you can provide?
Well, we've been working with this corn that I got connected with All Souls Tortilleria, and we started with Joe to develop, like, you know, how we can make it work with the Wapsie Valley, and we came up with a really good tasty arepa, and that's what we've been working with that Wapsie Valley. It's not like a native from here. I've been tasting some of the native corns, but I think that, you know, I think it goes into a lot into the cooking process, and just experiment and taste. You know, it's like, I feel like corn is like coffee, like, is very regional, so every different, even what Eric is saying is that the starchier and the sweet corn are very different, but I think that the variety and the diversity has a lot to do with how corn worked. Like I was learning about, like, how the indigenous people down in the area where I grew up at used to grow corn. They used to grow like four plants, and then they would put one that was like red, the cupacho, that would help with pest control and I don't know, and that's the way they grew it.
Yeah, look, that crop diversity, I'm told, also is very important from the point of view of trying to do pest control with minimal pesticide inputs and that kind of stuff as well. Let's go to talk about the arepas a little bit, because I think a lot of folks, you know, listening to the program here may not be familiar, maybe more familiar with things like tacos, or, you know, when they think of Latin American cornbread-based based food, that would be one place to go. How do they compare to tacos?
Well, I feel like the cooking process is a little different. Not much, but I feel like it's in the tenderness of how the cook is corn, so it makes it softer.
That's what I was going to ask. I wondered if they were softer to the, you know, in terms of mouthfeel or even in your hands. And are these things you do eat with your hands? I mean, you pick up an arepa and it's stuffed maybe with some vegetables or meats or whatever, and you eat them that way. Is that generally the idea?
It's like a flat bread, like a pita bread that you can eat with your hand.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I do different toppings. and I source all the toppings from like local farm source.
Mm-hmm.
I create this consciousness about like, you know, how we're gonna model what we really be, you know, and
practice what you preach, right? Move.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to present a model of like ethical farming and sustainable farming and how to we socially, you know, move forward in this whole regenerative process, you know.
I'm just going to say I'm pulling up pictures of arepas on Google right now. and to the Vermonter's eye, they look a little bit like pancakes, I got to say. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's like a thicker tortilla, and they come in different sizes, and there's like 60 different types of arepas in Colombia, and they've got from all different types of corn.
Yeah.
So the idea is to create like this incubator of like Latin American foods that have been monocropped and practically culturally disseminated the food, and bring back all that stuff back to because I feel like there's a huge market of that in densified areas, all these Latin American cultures that are dying to have something that's real, you know?
Yeah, I got to say, these look delicious. I'm here's a Venezuelan-style arepa. I would gather that's...
those are like cut a slice in the middle, and they stuff them with different stuff, yeah.
And I was going to say... looks like some nice. What do you like on an arepa? What do you stuff it with when you're gonna have a nice?
Our little menu is very simple. I source my beef from Shire Beef up here in Berkshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I get whatever he, you know, he has. So I do different cuts, but I usually do cooked beef, which is like a top round, and I boil it, and then I grind it, and then I mix it with hogao. Hogao is scallions and tomatoes sautéed on olive oil.
Hmm.
And that we always have in our table. It's like our staple little sauce there.
Yep.
That we always keep in our table, and we mix it with the beans or beef. If we want to make an egg, we throw a little bit of hogao and break an egg there. So we always have gao in our table.
Are these more lunch or dinner, or do people eat them for breakfast or any meal?
Any meal.
Wow.
Mostly breakfast.
Yep.
You know,
Eric von Wetberg, are you an arepa fan? Do you like to eat them?
I am an arepa fan. I lived in Miami for 7 years, and they were one of my favorite foods there.
Wow, and that's and what did you like for toppings or whatever or fillings?
I have a particular weakness for Colombian cheese, melted into it, and then a little bit of sort of a hot sauce, maybe a lomo saltada on the side, a nice cut of steak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, you are making me hungry. Hey, let's go to a caller. We have Sharon on the line from Warren. Good morning, Sharon.
Hi, I was just wondering, has he ever tried field corn rather than sweet corn? You know, cow corn.
We were talking about that, and apparently the cow corn. Well, let me ask you, Nando or Eric. I'll start with Nando, actually. Can cow corn, field corn, as Vermonters sometimes call field corn, cow corn, are interchangeable, really. Can that work as an ingredient for arepas, or do you need something different?
It's not going to give the traditional flavor.
I'm sorry, Eric, what was that?
It won't give the traditional flavor. It tends to be a little too tough, and it's largely bred for its productivity and for its capacity to hold up well as silage.
Yeah, right.
Instead of for the richness of flavor and its capacity to grind into a nice coarse cornmeal.
Yeah, I would gather that you'd want something there. I mean, I think a lot of Vermonters understand about cow corn and they understand about sugar corn. There are other varieties out there, and this sounds like it's somewhere else on the, if you were going to, you know, sort of create a bar chart with all these different varieties of corn along it, it'd be somewhere else on that bar chart, right?
Well, correct.
Yeah.
I don't know if it could be used. The only thing is that they spray all that corn.
Well, that is another issue there, and with glyphosate and other other things you don't necessarily want to be eating straight on.
And he talked about red corn. They just had a segment with that guy that does farm stuff on WCAX,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about the popcorn, and it's, you don't eat it, you make popcorn out of it, and it's red. I was just curious if that's something similar.
Again, I bet you, it's amazing how many different, if agriculture were kind of left alone and not affected by the forces that are diminishing crop diversity, you'd probably have 50 or 100 different varieties of corn available to buy in the general food economy, right? Is that fair, Eric?
That is fair. So in the 1880s, if you had gone to the Essex Fair,
mm-hmm.
you would have likely witnessed a corn contest. This was a common event across North America where at the county fair, farmers would bring in their own corn and they'd often have two or three. They might have a popcorn, a sweet corn that they'd keep somewhat separate. It's a little tricky to keep corn from pollinating because it's out-pollinating. But they would have a couple of corns and they bring them in and compare them and they might share, but those social processes kept a lot of corn diversity on the landscape. And my office neighbor here, Professor Yolanda Chen, is leading a project in Chiapas in Mexico now to look at indigenous farmers there who often keep multiple types of corn. They'll grow export corn or GMO corn, but they usually sell that, and then they'll keep several varieties for themselves.
Yeah, and I would expect that in some instances you're going to have these farmers who would have had, you know, an heirloom corn that was handed down to them from previous generations and their families and that kind of thing. No,
definitely.
So I think, Sharon, to your question, if you're still on the line, to that question about is popcorn and red corn the same thing, or
no, it's totally different.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. I don't think they are.
No, they're totally different.
Yep, Nando, the kind of corn you're looking for is just another on that, as I said, on that sort of chart of different corn varieties that somebody might draw or imagine or whatever. And the problem is that the corn you're looking for, which is, I gather, still obtainable in Colombia, is not so much easy to get when you're in the United States. Is that the problem?
No, I'm more interested in bringing back those old native strains of corn that were grown here,
mm-hmm.
you know, 1,000 years ago, and I feel like that we're just gonna have to work with that corn to see. I feel like it's like coffee. Coffee from Colombia doesn't taste the same as the one from Costa Rica.
And
vice versa. And I feel like the texture and stuff, it kind of interferes with it also. But I found like some
really good corn that we grow here, like the Mandan Bright or this Seneca Hominy,
mm-hmm.
that was grown here, that I connected with a bunch of seed savers here in Vermont during last winter, and that's how we got to experiment all these types of corn.
So in your experiments, Nando, have you been able to come up with a corn that really works for you now?
We're still in the tasting processing mm-hmm. process because they try to do like little batches of different corn.
Yep.
So it's very limited to the amount of corn that we could use to really experiment in different methods.
Mm-hmm.
But I've come out with like really good masa from this another corn that was given to. It was this Flint that girl, what's her name? Darby, Heather.
Heather Darby? Mm-hmm.
From UBM.
Yep.
She grew it, and that came out really good too.
Huh.
So we're just trying to figure out what are we gonna I'm into just diversity, you know.
Yeah, sure. Eric, when you hear this story from Nando, and I'm sure. You know, one of the reasons you're connected up with him is because of this story, and because of this. This is a great example of how important it is to have different varieties of different crops available to people for all their various purposes. What is the lesson to be taken from all of this?
So, part of what intrigues me so much about this is. Enriching local food, both diversity and uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont is a state carved up by mountains. We have some great soils and some really challenging soils. We know it has never been easy to farm, and the mix of trade wars, a complicated global scene, and market consolidation has made it really difficult for our farmers. We have a mandate to help. One of the things that we can do is introduce diversity and celebrate it in a local sense. So one of the things that Nando has repeatedly mentioned is the unique taste that things have in from different places. The French, for better or worse, have long called this terroir. You know, the idea that a wine from a particular place has a unique flavor.
Yep.
The Vermont brand has great value, and we can celebrate that with a range of corn from old Abenaki varieties to cow corn to sweet corn. Yeah. Popcorn and arepas, and on to the roasting corn that some of the resettled refugees, excuse me, and new Americans in Chittenden County are starting to grow. So we're excited to work with anyone to create new options so that we can keep things vibrant.
I think a very important development that people are starting to take this stuff, it seems like, more seriously and really put a push on to try to make sure that we maintain not only crop diversity, but just diversity in food offerings. And I don't know, part of me thinks it'd be kind of a lovely thing to have Nando, have you develop a reputation where folks would drive from 100 miles away to Norwich, Vermont, because there's a food truck guy up there who makes the perfect arepa out of your own local variety of corn. I mean, that seems like that's the nirvana you're looking for, right?
Well, I feel like heart is used to connect with the here and show them what we're doing and the whole mission of the the project is to, you know, create this value-added economy here.
Very, very important. Hey, you know what? I hate to do this, but I've got to call it because we're about at the top of the hour here, which means the end of my program for today. But yeah, there you go. Sorry. Eric Von Wetberg, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Dave Graham Show. A real pleasure talking with you. Okay. That's about it for the show today, folks. Tune in again tomorrow. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Have a great day, everybody. Happy trick-or-treating.